You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Oh, wow. It's time for Dear Science, thanks to MoTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
So, welcome back to Dear Science. Shame that we couldn't do it in the studio.
Yes, good to be back. It would be easier in the studio, certainly, but it's good to be here.
Definitely. COVID has ruined a lot of things, so Dear Science is apparently one of them. But anyway, we've got some good stuff today. First of all, Russia and Ukraine, that's been dominating the headlines. But the global research community has kind of taken another step to condemn this invasion as well. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I think this is part of obviously a much wider condemnation of what Russia's been doing in Ukraine. And it's really unleashed an outpouring of condemnation from scientists and research organizations across the world. Some organizations in Western nations have moved pretty quickly to sever links with Russia, cutting off funding and resources, and really ending collaboration with basically much of Russian science. And national science academies and groups of researchers have issued statements really sharply criticizing the conflict and supporting the Ukrainian colleagues. And in Ukraine, scientists are pressuring nations to freeze Russia out of their science programs, and they're calling on Russian institutions or institutes and scientific leaders to condemn the invasion.
These kinds of, like, you've got sanctions and stuff, but why punish scientists?
Well, I think most of them are innocent actors. I mean, I don't know enough about the politics in Russia to be able to sort of to say, but I think most people in Russia don't really have much of a say over what is done by their leader, and certainly they probably haven't had much of a say over this invasion. And there's thousands of scientists in Russia who say that they are appalled by their government's actions. In a letter organized by researchers in Russia signed by more than 5,000 people, scientists strongly condemn the hostilities and say that Russian leadership has launched an unjustifiable war for the sake of its geopolitical ambitions. And that includes 85 scientists who are members of the Russian Academy of Sciences, so pretty high up, which is a government body that oversees much of the nation's research. I mean, whether they're innocent or not, I think it's a statement to say, you know, we cannot support anything that's being done in Russia while these actions are going on. So, for instance, among the strongest actions taken so far is the decision by a group of Germany's largest research funders, including the German Research Foundation, to freeze all scientific cooperation with Russia. So on the 25th of February, the group said that the country's research funds will no longer benefit Russia, that no joint scientific events will take place and no new collaborations will begin. And there's a lot of funding that comes from Germany and the rest of the EU that goes into Russia. Russia's an active science partner with the EU and other places. And it's basically all going to come to a stop. Another example in the US, the MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, has ended its relationship with the Skolovko Foundation, which is a Moscow-based nonprofit organization focusing in innovation. In 2011, they launched the Skolovko Institute of Science and Technology, or Skoltek, in Moscow. And they said, with deep regret, because I have a great respect for the Russian people and a profound appreciation for the contributions of many extraordinary Russian colleagues we have worked with, they've decided to end that partnership. So this is happening all over the place, it's just one of many things that's happening. But science is definitely taking an active role to try and put the pressure on Russia.
Is this shutting out of Russian science going to be particularly detrimental to the field of research for the global community?
I mean, Russia contributes quite widely to science globally, they make a major contribution, and that they have a hand in a bunch of international collaborations. But this is just what has to happen at the moment, I think.
Now, moving on to our second topic for today, Omicron. It's the COVID variant that has been dominating case numbers around the world and causing most of the deaths that we've been seeing recently. It's only the most recent variant in the pandemic. How inevitable is it that we're going to get another variant? Is it just a matter of time?
Well, that's the big question. So scientists are thinking that maybe it's just a matter of time before a new variant emerges. So Omicron brought a sort of a fresh wave of COVID infections and a lot of anxiety at the start of 2022. Many nations have gotten through that. Some nations are starting to record a decline in case numbers. Obviously, New Zealand is still getting thousands of cases every day. Hong Kong is another example. They're going through a pretty awful hit of cases. And after 2 years of oscillating between pandemic surges and retreats, you know, people in most countries can't really help but wonder when the next blow will come and what form it will take. And scientists really think it's inevitable that we'll see new variants with varying degrees of immune evasion. And they could emerge anywhere, especially wherever there is widespread transmission. So New Zealand, is seeing record cases and or has seen record cases, and certainly a new variant could even emerge in New Zealand. And so as people are waiting, or scientists are really waiting for a new variant to enter the scene, the scientists are really studying the Omicron variant as best they can to try and predict the future, and they're trying to really figure out the answer to a few key questions, and that's sort of, you know, when will the next variant of concern emerge, and really will the next variant cause severe disease, and will vaccines be able to be effective against whatever that variant is?
I think it's quite concerning, especially when Omicron was found to, you know, not be as responsive to the vaccine. So we had to have that massive booster campaign. But yes. I don't know, just seems like we're constantly running behind in terms of how quickly this virus is evolving and how we just have to scramble to catch up.
Right. And there's no way to know for sure when a variant will become dominant or whether it will rise to the status of a variant of concern. You know, there's the public is probably most familiar with the first couple of dominant subvariants, Omicron and prior to that Delta. But researchers have been tracking a host of related subvariants that are sort of jockeying for dominance. So in the UK, for example, one Delta variant called AY.4 was in the process of being rapidly displaced by another called AY.4.2 in late 2021. And then Omicron came along and just blew up. And both of those got swamped. But whether a particular variant will rise to the level of a variant of concern remains an open question. At present, the original Omicron lineage, so it's called BA1, is being replaced by another called BA2, still called Omicron. And in New Zealand, we have BA2, not BA1. I think we have a mix of the two, actually.
Catchy names, lineage, aren't they?
Yeah, they're very catchy. Well, I think they're being replaced so often. New variants are emerging so with such regularity that, you know, you have to just have the systematic names.
God, we're going to run out of Greek letters at this rate.
That's right. but there will be variants. The worry now is that the close scrutiny of the virus is already diminishing. So testing rates in the UK, for instance, have declined. Testing rates in New Zealand, I think, are starting to decline. Because if Omicron produces a relatively mild disease, people are less likely to seek testing. Governments become less proactive, encouraging tests. So this will eventually weaken the SARS-CoV-2 genomic surveillance efforts. And so we won't necessarily know when a new variant has appeared or where it's appeared. It will just sort of take over, and eventually we'll figure it out. So,
scary.
I mean, yeah, COVID is the most studied. We've never been able to watch a virus emerge and spread before, like we have with COVID. I mean, other viruses, the flu virus every year and other things, they're just there, and we're not really watching very closely. But never before have we been able to sort of watch a virus and how it mutates and spreads around as much as we have with COVID. Very hard.
Yeah, I think it's kind of, yeah, complacency, and people kind of just in their minds considering the pandemic is over. But well, this actually brings us to our last topic, which is quite handy.
Yes.
When do we even decide that the pandemic is over? So that's quite up to debate, obviously. But the World Health Organization, that's kind of is that the final organization that makes that call?
Yes, they do. They've every 3 months since early 2020, the World Health Organization has convened to assess whether this pandemic still merits that label, whether it's still going to be called a pandemic. And every 3 months, most recently in this January, the advisors have unanimously agreed that it does. And it's likely to reach the same conclusion next month when it meets again, and probably for quite a few more meetings after that. We still do have a global pandemic. People are still dying by the thousand globally. And at some point, though, estimates range from maybe months to years from now, WHO will make a different call. And as you sort of say, already nations like Denmark, Netherlands, the UK, have functionally, at least, declared an end to the pandemic, lifting almost all their health restrictions, even as places like New Zealand and Hong Kong struggle with record-breaking surges. And so deciding when to sound the all clear is not really an enviable task. And, you know, do you call it over when there might still be a wave in one part of the world, but it's only a small part of the world? So it's a difficult thing to do, and how do you judge that? SARS-CoV-2 has caused such hardship and economic challenges that there's sort of a temptation to call it over sooner rather than later. Everyone's done with it. Everyone just wants it to be over. But I think wanting it to be over and actually it being over are two quite different things.
Yeah, I think people kind of, yeah, again, like I said, mentally they're wanting it to be over, and then they've kind of internalized that. I've just seen people walking around like bars and stuff with no masks on. It's just kind of, yeah, people don't seem to be as concerned about it anymore, even in New Zealand when we see 20,000 plus cases a day.
That's right. But it's something that we need to think carefully about, or the WHO needs to think carefully about, because just its formal declaration, so it's called it's declared a public health emergency of international concern, or a FIKE, I don't know the acronym, but anyway, it's a public health emergency of international concern. So that's the formal declaration, and that legally binds 169 signatories to follow WHO's recommendations during the emergency. And importantly, drug makers have also signed contracts agreeing to make anti-SARS-CoV-2 pills more affordable until that public health emergency of international concern, or PHEIC, is reversed. So this is important. That's a big thing to consider, because while it's still in place, the drugs are going to be cheaper, and that's going to be important for, especially for developing nations. You know, you think even for New Zealand, because we spend a lot of money on drugs and we're not getting some of the drugs, maybe because they're too expensive. And so we could use every help we can get as well. But if the WHO decides to end this declaration, then presumably those drugs will go up in price. And while COVID will still be around, it's always going to be here now. It'll be more expensive to treat.
Yeah, I think it's kind of just a case of balancing everyone's interests, because
very, very challenging.
Something that we'll just have to keep an eye on for the next few months, or like you said, years, which is quite a long time. Yeah. So anyway, thank you for your time today, Marcus. Really appreciate it. Welcome.
Mind blown. That was Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, Auckland's Museum of Transport and Technology.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.